Toy Power Podcast is a free podcast made possible by the support of our awesome Patreon sponsors. Head to toypowerpodcast.com and see how you can help.
Oh yeah, this is power.
Hello and welcome to Toy Power, the podcast where we talk toys and everything pop culture. I'm Trent and it's wonderful to have your company today for episode
83.
This week on Toy Power, we're doing our toy line retrospective, this time on the 2000X Masters of the Universe reboot. And at the end, we might have a bit of a conversation around which is the best Ninja Turtle. With me today in the studio, we've got Darren.
Hello, everyone.
Ben.
G'day, g'day.
And Frank.
Ahoy, ahoy.
Let's do it.
Vintage Toy Line Retrospective.
You've got to come back with me.
Where does it get those wonderful toys?
You're an action figure.
You're mocking me, aren't you?
The 2000X toy line came about, obviously, in 2002. Following the release of two waves of the Masters of the Universe commemorative series reissues based on the vintage line, Mattel embarked on a new Masters of the Universe mainstream line. There were many changes from how this line was presented when compared to many past lines, as well as many similarities. One of the key differences was not only the number of variants, but the frequency and how they were offered. For example, the release of a new variant of He-Man no longer automatically guaranteed the release of a corresponding Skeletor. For example, Jungle Attack He-Man did not see a simultaneous release of a Skeletor figure, which up until then all previous lines had.
What would have that been, do we think? Like Swamp Attack Skeletor or something? Like
Vine Attack
Skeletor. Vine Attack would have been the ultimate opposite, wouldn't it?
Anyway, go
it's
on.
It's a very cool point. So I guess the beginning of the story takes us to the Four Horsemen Studios. They had recently left their past employer, as they've talked about numerous times, and one of the first things they wanted to do was meet with Mattel to discuss a possible new Masters Universe line. And very much serendipitously, as the planets were aligning, no pun intended, given what we're talking about, Mattel also wanted to bring Masters Universe back, so it seemed to be a happy plan. So the Four Horsemen had a very different pitch in mind to what we actually saw. They weren't envisioning a reboot. They were envisioning something of a sequel where Skeletor had gained both halves of the Power Sword and thusly control of Castle Grayskull, and Adam would now transform into He-Man with the help of the Sorceress and Man-at-Arms, creating a new sort of power that would combine sword and sorcery with technology. Mattel wanted the reboot route, wanted to go down the reboot road, and that was how the line went. Jeremy Padua was the Master Universe brand manager for most of the toy line's run. Ian Richter was Mattel's representative on entertainment, and he liaised with both Mike Young Productions and MV Creations, the comic book publisher, and had quite a bit of input into the stories for both. The late Dean Steffen was also story editor on MV Creations cartoon.
Darren, you did mention the Four Horsemen's original vision, which was to essentially Skeletor would have both halves of the Power Sword, He-Man would have to have a sword of technology. You can actually see that in the toys.
Yep.
That when you look at Skeletor's sword, he's got a good and an evil half of the Power Sword, and they're quite nicely sculpted. One has an eagle sort of hilt, representing the good half of the sword, and the other one has sort of a more
snake
scalp. Is it a snake?
I thought it was like a scaly dragon type stuff.
Yeah, I'm trying to picture it, but it's clearly an evil half. The ram skull sort of look, I think.
Oh, okay.
It really does modernize the whole idea of the two halves of the Power Sword, doesn't it?
It does, yeah, it's very clever. And He-Man's Power Sword is that technological custom-built piece of machinery, which I think the concept was it was meant to sort of harmonize with the power of Grayskull, so artificially create the same power that was created by the magic.
Yeah. So. And just on, to unpack that a little bit more, you've got He-Man wearing the same outfit. You've got him wearing the brown boots, you know, the loincloth, the harness, the blonde, you know, hair and things. So it's He-Man is essentially recognizable to any He-Man fan around the world, so to speak. He's even to the extent he's got the very similar shield. But then you've got this very different sword that doesn't really show any harken to the original Power Sword. So that sort of explaining it that way sort of gives the audience or the fans or us for even the reason why it looks so different and gives a storyline and a bit of an acceptance of why it's so, you know, vastly different. And a little bit his, to that extent, his axe has also got some power elements along the blade and things, but it's still essentially the same double-sided axe and traditionally, you know, recognizable to the vintage axe itself. So it's just mainly the sword that's so different.
Vastly different.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah. Yeah. And to take such an iconic sword, I mean, that Power Sword design is tremendously iconic. So you can see a lot of the original fans' reaction to that would have been quite averse, because he is this very different looking sword with no explanation, as Ben said.
It's very interesting because I can remember when this was announced on He-Man.org back in the day, like we're talking 2001, when that was showcased. It was originally announced by Mattel that Skeletor had gained by far the sword of power, so that it effectively announced that continuity. And then I guess because you can announce things and until they hit retail, you can still tweak things, and obviously the cartoon wasn't as far along that they couldn't tweak things. So it ended up being very different, but I'd always remembered that was the initial announcement that we were given as to the storyline for this, that this was something of a sequel, that Skeletor had control and had both halves of the sword, and that we were seeing a very different sort of power with a very different story to it. I was kind of shocked when that was gone.
Yeah. As someone who wasn't really following the franchise in the lead up to the 2002 stuff, how was that change received by, you know, the greater fan base? Was it like full on outcry? Was this Michael Bay's Ninja Turtles stuff all over again? Like, how was that?
It was nothing like that at all. I think most fans were just totally excited that we're getting a new
line, a reboot,
that there was a cartoon coming alongside it. Later on, we'd hear there'd be a comic book. There was a lot of excitement. There was some fear and trepidation on some fans' part. I can remember being nervous anxious, actually, is probably a better word, from the day it was announced that it may not take off, and it being so important to me that it did.
Yeah.
So that was sort of the least of my worries as to what the sort of power I wanted. I wanted this line to have a long life. I wanted it to deliver me characters that I'd always wanted in the vintage line that I never got to do, but I also wanted to see what the redesigns would be like for all the characters I did have. I wanted it to last for years and years.
Yeah.
I do with every Masters line.
Yeah, I mentioned the weapon specifically because in light of the rise of Ninja Turtles, the cartoon, and how they totally changed up the weapons, I just remember that, but that's, and still is, a big sort of focal point for a lot of fans. And I don't know, I mean, I guess ultimately it's still a sword, right? It's just the styling is different, and it's, you know, instead of sorcery, it's going down the technology route. I just wondered if there was any sort of outcry about that.
Just on that, Frank, like, just to take it back to the 90s where they changed it for the He-Man and the New Adventures. It was a sort of lightsaber, dare I say that, you know, from Star Wars. But that's the idea they took away from Star Wars, is like, let's make the Power Sword an energy sword in space, you know. So I don't think, whilst, you know, internet was still early, you know, back in 2000, and I certainly wasn't following He-Man as closely back then as I do now, but, you know, for a sword for them to say in words and maybe throw a few pics around to say the sword was changing but leaving He-Man all the same, I don't think it was a huge oh my gosh factor.
No, you know? I don't recall it being
right,
that.
Cool.
I recall watching the transformation sequence without batting an eyelid, and then later having a conversation with Darren where he expressed that there were, if anything, a lot of fans were upset by how they treated the transformation sequence, how that was animated, being a significant departure to how it happens in the original filmation series.
People felt it was a bit flat. That was the consensus I was seeing online frequently, not only on the He-Man.org forums, but on the Guardians of Grayskull mailing list and a lot of other places. People were thinking the transformation was just not quite as energetic as they were liking it. And I don't know how closely people have watched it, but if you can see from season two, there was a change.
Because, but they ramped it up?
They ramped it up more. The transformation is a much more epic thing. Not that I think it was as flat as other people did. No, I didn't have a problem with it per se myself, but a lot of people did. And people like Ian Richter and Dean Stefan and that were engaging with people on the forums on He-Man.org from the pilot going on Cartoon Network. Because they really wanted to sort of see what fans were thinking about it. So they took that on board. But obviously, by the time that aired, season one was already in the can. So nothing was going to change. That's right. But from the very first episode of season two, they had reanimated the transformation sequence to be something even bigger. And I believe I have the power is even louder. And it just feels there's more, for want of a better term, more power, more oomph to it.
Mm.
And I remember the reaction to that being very positive. Fans were very happy with that change for season two.
Mm. On the segue to change, right, what does everyone think about the He-Man, persona as Adam being a younger boy rather than an adult changing into a more muscly Adam?
I really liked it because, let's face it, the visuals is a big part of the character. In filmation, look, I love it and I know I have a certain amount of nostalgia for it. And I know what they were going for and why they were doing what they did. But essentially, it's He-Man with a white shirt and a pink vest. It's not, and he's not even wearing glasses.
It's worse than that idea.
So when I saw this, I'm like, well, that's how it should always be portrayed.
Yep.
That there's a real physical change, that he grows in strength and you see a more muscly representation of him. So I quite like that change. I thought that change made sense visually and fitted in with the story.
Definitely fitted in with the story. The series Bible that Michael Haplin wrote for the original filmation story was that of Adam and He-Man having an age difference and looking different. That wasn't necessarily realised in filmation, and I think that suited Mattel at the time too, because you think when they got to the vintage Adam figure, they could reuse the He-Man figure without having to sculpt a new one. But this, in many ways, was truer to that series Bible, and I think it gave them latitude, as Trent said, the visual difference and the explanation as to why people may not associate Adam and He-Man together was that stark difference helped sell that. So, yeah, I really liked that as well. I thought that was a real positive. Not that I disliked the filmation version either. I always am one of those people that think it doesn't have to be a choice between one or the other with any property. Lots of different things can coexist and I think for me that just really worked. I thought the figure was quite a good scale too, in that it scaled down and kept true to what the cutting was saying. Maybe the hair sculpt didn't quite capture him as he appeared in the cutting in the comics, but small gripe, I guess.
Mm.
I think it fit the audience better. Like, whilst I was, 18, 19 years old when this came out, maybe a little older also. But, for their aimed audience, let's say, the 10-year-old kid, you can ground the younger Adam a lot better to a 10-year-old than you can an already, full-blown adult.
Yeah.
And, with the power, he grows to He-Man and all of a sudden he's got these enormous muscles and things and he can suddenly move a planet or whatever needs to be done. So
The other thing I noticed in terms of changes, or one of the things that was really apparent to me on the original sculpt of the figure and then maybe to a lesser extent in the animation style, but was the anime style of face they put on the He-Man figure. I always felt it was probably a weaker choice than what they could have gone with, and understanding the background and the research of why they came up with the final
look.
He-Man look in the face was that they took a few different versions of that to market research to kids to see what would test the best with them. And I think it is a bit of a sign of the times is that that anime style was very popular and drove a lot of influences that maybe the Four Horsemen wouldn't have chosen as their first choice. But, you know, you're not going to necessarily go against testing because that is essentially your market and that's who you're wanting to sell the products to. So I always felt that that head we got with the He-Man was never quite right. And for me on this line, there's a figure that came later, which was called Ice Armor He-Man. And even when you get into the Snake Armor He-Man, the heads on those later figures were much more refined and in my opinion, much better heads of He-Man. Yeah.
That is a brilliant version of He-Man as far as variants go. And I'll tell you something about that just as a little side
story. Sorry, which one was that, Adam?
The Ice Armor He-Man.
Darren.
That Trent mentioned.
Yep.
The trivia behind that is that Scott Knight, like when he was originally pitching a Masters of the Universe online line, was pitching to Mattel that they take that sculpt and retool it into the King Grayskull San Diego Comic-Con exclusive that they ended up offering. That was sort of pre-classics. His idea was do a 2002 Masters of the Universe follow-up line and offer it online. And Mattel had a different idea about taking something that harkened more back to the vintage line, gave them a chance to start again with A-list characters rather than sort of picking up where 2000 and X left off. And I think that's a really fascinating point that was the go-to He-Man for a King Grayskull sculpt because it's a bigger, bulkier He-Man as well, but gets the face sculpt so right.
Yes. Yeah, very good. I don't know if this is probably the right time to talk about it, but there were, in terms of unproduced toys, we'll talk a little bit about this, I think, where there was a push to get the Snake Man ahead of the Horde in continuity. Unfortunately, we only got 39 episodes and then the show got cancelled and we never really fleshed out that arc, which was going to be the sort of the season 3 arc around the Horde invasion. We sort of got some teasers to that. But along with that, there was also some really nice prototypes. We would have got essentially a Horde Armor He-Man, and from what the Four Horsemen were sculpting, if you've got the original made by Mattel book that was limited to 1,000 pieces at San Diego, but they show some of those images where he's actually got the crew cut.
Yes.
And that's quite another unique look that they would have gone with, and I think that's kind of cool. What they were doing was refreshing the look, upgrading He-Man every season, giving him a new power, like they did in the vintage line with, you know, but with the figures, not
but
really
building it into the story.
But building it into the story.
And I think that was a really cool way of doing it. As Trent said, it sort of legitimized some of the variants. Doesn't feel quite as excessive if there's a story behind it. And I think new powers for new enemies always make sense, particularly when you can contextualize that. You know that King Grayskull or Hero or the Elders went up against some of these opponents. They'd know what it would take to defeat them. So I think that really helps sell it. There's some other unproduced prototypes that we saw along the way as well that the Four Horsemen had that may have become part of the Staction line or the 2000X line, like Spike Horde and Horde Trooper, that were showcased. Unfortunately, never occurred that they showed them at a PowerCon a few years ago.
Interesting. For me, I mean, you talk about how not disappointing, but it was unfortunate that the Horde characters never made it into the cartoon and things. And honestly, that is unfortunate. However, I've got a shout out that we saw the Snake Men. We cannot, you know, just brush over the fact
that
they
were Snake Men. Yeah, to see them in animation for the first time was a big deal.
Exactly, because, you know, they never got their limelight in filmation, as, you know, many people understand. And for me, I had most of the Snake Men in the vintage line, so they never really fleshed out that storyline.
Yep.
You can collect all the comics and things you want, but sometimes it's just that next level of understanding and, you know, storytelling to see it, you know, on animated or, you know, whatever. And for me, that was the so awesome. I cannot underrate that enough, and that was probably the biggest high point of my 2000X fandom of the cartoon, was fleshing those that faction of the universe out and seeing something we hadn't seen previously.
I tend to agree. I was just disappointed we didn't see the second half of what they obviously had planned, yeah, because they were such a force to reckon with. You look at that first two-parter and how they knock off the evil warriors so quickly and the heroic warriors too, for that matter. And you just think, where would this season have gone if it had continued? And
well, it would have gone into Man-at-Arms being bitten by a snake and turning into a snake.
Yeah, I know. And I know how controversial that is with the fan base for a number of reasons, but I can also see that from Mattel's point of view, he can start churning out snake vehicles pretty easily, and you've got a new product line. Mm.
I just got to call out, like, you know, characters that they really fleshed out that we'd never really, just background characters, or, you know, let's just put him in here and he does one thing and that's it. So you know, the biggest character that stands out for me is Odifus, right? So he's, you know, started off the episode, and I can't remember the episode, Darren will know it off by heart, but anyway.
Snake Pit, was it?
Probably. So Odifus, you see this unusual creature and he's just doing his thing and things. Anyway, long story short, watching the episode, all of a sudden he gets turned into Stinkor.
Oh, yes,
and you
right.
just, you yeah, know, it just,
victory.
Just that, you know, watching that episode back in the day, I'm like, oh yeah, cool, another episode of Masters, this would be good. And just the twist of the way the story went, and it just blew me away. I'm like, oh my god, I've got a massive appreciation now for Stinkor, whereas before I just like, oh yeah, he's one of the evil villains, but now all of a sudden I've got a backstory for him, and I've got, you know, he's got a reason why he's angry and reason why he's, you know, it pits that smell, and it's just, I love that depth that they
there
went
was so
to.
So much continuity to that, because he actually cameos in the episode Snake Pit. He's in the prison when you see Corporal Card for the first time, and he has a line, and then you don't see anything of him until several episodes later when he comes back into it in the Smell of Victory. I think that was the name of the episode. The Stinkor episode anyway, late in season one, and it just sort of lays the ground for, you know, how much continuity and depth there were between episodes as well, and it felt very serialized, very linked, and like it was building to something. So, would have just been sensational to see where they would have taken it had the series gone on.
Yeah, look, I think if I had to summarize what we're all saying here is that we love the cartoon, in essence. Like, there was some changes, and not everybody's going to like every single change, but there was a lot of good stuff in that cartoon and a lot of room for growth and that sort of stuff. So that then begs the question, you know, how did that translate to the toys? And why did the toys ultimately not go on to a season 3 and beyond and that sort of stuff? So I just wanted to sort of, you know, go around the room as far as from a toy sort of thing. We've talked about the, you know, He-Man's head sculpt and that sort of thing, but looking across the line broadly, where do we think the toy line succeeded, where do we think it didn't succeed, and you know, talk about that.
It's a really good question, and to that point on the cartoon, often looking back on it, you say, why didn't this thing take off or succeed? Because that cartoon is a solid quality production. And you have to understand, I think, with this, the key driver for the cartoon is to get kids interested and get them into the toys. The toys clearly came first, right? So the horsemen were sculpting these toys, and then that look was used to sort of animate the series to some extent. So I think you got a couple of issues here. One, the cartoon availability was always an issue. So I think if you're talking to the US market,
it's screened on Cartoon Network exclusively in the US.
The one network.
Right.
Yeah.
So there's an issue.
So if you don't have pay TV, you're probably not going to see it.
No. And even then, I think there were some time slot changes that occurred where people complaining about, oh, now it's gone to this time slot, now I'm going to follow it over to here. So the distribution of the cartoon was probably not there to start with. The toys, we had issues here in Australia with availability, right? They basically didn't come out here, essentially. Now, there's some exceptions.
We got part of Wave 1, the 6 primary figures, He-Man, Skeletor, Teela, Man and Apps.
No, we didn't get Teela.
No, we didn't get Teela. Why did I say Teela? I'm thinking the vintage line. He-Man, Skeletor, Man-at-Arms, Stratos, Beastman, Merman,
yeah.
Battle Cat. We didn't get Panther, we didn't get Battle Sound He-Man, we didn't get Battle Sound Skeletor. So we missed part of the first wave, and then we didn't get another complete wave again until the very final wave of Master of the Universe versus the Snake Man.
Yeah.
Suddenly they decided they're going to distribute it here.
And the only reason we got that first wave was because basically everyone complained to the toy stores, the distributors.
Yeah, and I kept ringing the 1-800 Mattel
number. Well, we can probably
which I can give to people.
We can thank Darren for that because it came.
Darren's persistence.
I kept ringing them saying, when's this stuff going
to
come?
It came to Australia really late.
Yeah,
to Australia really late. But you know what the funniest thing is? The first conversation I had with one of the workers there, she's like, are you sure Mattel made Master of the Universe? Maybe you should call Hasbro.
Stop calling this number.
Yeah.
Darren just hangs up on her.
Seriously, that was a major issue. Toys R Us did get a few odds and ends as exclusives in Australia. So the Battle Armor He-Man and Battle Armor Skeletor, which
bear no resemblance to
the vintage counterparts. Yeah. But the Battle Armor Skeletor did remind me a lot of Terracles Skeletor. Yep. But the Battle Raptor, the Samurai Battle Cat, the Slime Pit, which also bear no resemblance to the vintage one. And Castle Grayskull, funnily enough, was released when that last wave of the Snake Master Universe.
It was the 2.0 Castle Grayskull.
It was the 2.0 Castle Grayskull.
And it was released at Kmart, so it wasn't
even seen that.
Target had some as well.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Mm. But yeah, going back to the demise, or why it probably didn't take off. Hard to say. So if the show wasn't widely distributed, were kids exposed to it enough to then go into the stores and kind of want to buy them? There was also, who are they marketing the toys to? Now, clearly when Mattel goes, we want to relaunch Masters, their target market is going to be mainstream, you know, kid audiences, right? Collectors are probably going to be cream on the top. And they're not in the target market testing, right? They're testing for kids. So this is a line that they have to sell to kids. They got into trouble very early on with the way they approached their variants. So, look, case ratios and mixes is always a challenge. And you know, when companies don't get it right, things shoot up on eBay at the collector end, and things warm the pegs at the other end. But the real problem was, I think, my recollection was it was the Spin Blade and the Smash Blade and the Skeletor, which were essentially the same figures as original vintage He-Man and vintage Skeletor.
But repainted in slightly different colours with accessories. A few different weapons. But basically the ratios were like this. I remember the ratios very clearly. You have a case that of six figures, and it would be either Heroic Warriors or Evil Warriors in separate cases. So your case ratios to use that wave as your example, were four Smashblade He-Mans, one Orko, one Teela. And the Evil Warriors equivalent was four Spin Blade Skeletors and a Trapjaw and a Triclops. And that was your case of six. And people just couldn't find particularly characters like Teela and Orko anywhere. So they'd go online and they'd buy a Teela for what seemed like to be a comparable price to the Mint on Card Vintage Teela. Just to sort of round it out. Meanwhile, stores cannot move these Smash Blade Spin Blades. And I'm sure Trent remembers as clearly as I do all the people on He-Man.org and the terms that were coming. You know, it was sort of basically hashtag killing the line. You know, hashtag Mattel killing the line. Because that's how people felt. And that's where the anger and animosity seemed to be around. I've had to drive all over town. I've had to drive all over my city from one end to the other. Think about how big the US is compared to Australia. You know, people driving from shopping centre to find these things, and they'd either have a really bad day or you know, they'd feel they won Cross Lotto because they found a Teela or an Orko.
Yeah.
I think you've got to look at what else is being released at the time. So they were in direct opposition to the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
Their second year. They weren't in the first year.
Yeah. So they were in the direct, you know, which is also a bit of a homage to the, you know, it was a reboot. It was a reboot line of the an earlier version. So you've probably got kids growing up that were a bit more in tune, you know, like that they were still ready to watch cartoons sort of at that age, to watch a Ninja Turtles reboot, whereas I believe for Masters, you're getting more adults catching it instead of the second last half of their teenage years ready to watch a cartoon. So if that makes sense.
Yeah, it makes perfect sense, especially when you consider the Fred Wolf Turtles cartoon ran for 10 seasons. People at the tail end of that, they might remember it, but only came in the last couple of seasons, might still be watching at the point of 2003. Yeah. So it does make sense.
So that... Sorry.
I was just going to say, but they're really, if they've done their job correctly, Mattel should be hitting a new audience
of those
kids. And clearly...
That was the purpose of rebeating it rather than doing the sequel that the Four Horsemen had pitched.
Yeah. And clearly they've missed something with connecting with that audience. Yep. I agree there's those... And I agree once you get to the toy shelves as well, there's competition going on there. And if Turtles is a bigger property, kids' money... goes to that and attention goes to that. So it might have just been unfortunate time.
I will give you my 2 cents worth on this.
Can I just continue sec? So to continue the segue of competition, I just got a shout out for my personal outtake on when I was shopping for Masters of the Universe 2000X lines. So I'd walk into a store and I'd be like, yeah, that's cool. Masters of the Universe are back. They look wicked. But they're very anime style. Like they've got that hyper detail. And that was kind of cool. It wasn't departure from the cartoon. You sort of saw that in the cartoon, so it wasn't foreign. But what stopped me from buying the line is on the peg next to it was Marvel Legends. So we talked about this in a previous podcast with Deadpool figure. You know, this Deadpool figure boasts 40 points of articulation, right? And you're talking about a Masters of the Universe character that has the same articulation points as the vintage line, 5 points of articulation. And it was almost like the McFarlane toys that were being released, the hyper detail movie-esque McFarlane lines. You had one pose. You could put it in this dynamic style where the left foot is, you know, arching out from the right foot, and they were going to leap forward, and that's the only pose you could have standing up, in battle pose. Now, you could argue Ninja Turtles had that to a certain extent, both in the vintage line and such, and in the 2000X line. But with the Ninja Turtles, they had almost ball joints at their arms, and they had swivels at their wrist and things, and so they had a lot more articulation than the Masters lines. And I was almost taken back, you know, by the Masters of the Universe 2000X line, by, you know, I'm not buying value for money with this pre-posed figure. So I passed on all those. But then moving forward, once the Stactions came out and the enormous departure of size, and, you know, like they really captured the size and things, and they were marketed as statues. So I was happy to pick them up, and they were marketed as characters that, you know, were some of my favorites. So that also appealed to me in that sense, that snout spout and things. So I was pretty quick to grab them, but that was, you know, that was years later after seeing, you know, what was on retail toy shelves in a lineup, of all fighting for my dollar, so to speak.
Yeah, I'll probably talk to my experience of trying to find it as well. This was for me when I was sort of, you know, a few years out of high school and get, you know, full-time job and had all this extra money because I was still living at home. Yay. And this was also, as a big Turtles fan, I got big into the 2003 line. And then I saw this Master. I was like, oh my God, it's my childhood all over again. Two of my all-time favorites coming back in a new form that should be easy to collect. And that was true for one of those lines, because short of the, you know, the as we said, the ones that were overstocked everywhere, I specifically remember spending a whole lot of time on the internet trying to find, you know, a Teela and an Orko and all these sorts of ones. I was able to collect a lot of that, and I got into the Stactions and all that sort of stuff as well. But compared to the Turtles, where I'm going to call my line of the 2003 stuff pretty damn complete, I would estimate 80% of that I picked up off the shelf versus Masters, which is 2080 the other direction. you know, having to go online and that sort of stuff. And look, I probably overpaid on a number of those things because I was young and dumb and had more money than sense. But yeah, it was a very different collecting experience. To Ben's point about the Stactions, that was also the line for me where I really valued sculpt over articulation. Yeah. I thought the Four Horsemen stuff were amazing. To that point, I hadn't followed a lot of the McFarlane sort of stuff, and this was the first one where I went, wow, who are these Four Horsemen? Because they are doing the Lord's work sort of thing. So I was a big fan of that, and you know, went and sought all that. But again, you couldn't source it locally. You had to go online. And I think, you know, when we talk about factors as to why it didn't become a huge sort of, you know, 6, 7, 8 year line, the distribution is probably top of that list for me.
I think that would be top of most people's list. I would also say it struggled to know what it wanted to be. It was supposedly marketed to kids, you know, the storyline was revolved around it being a reboot, not a sequel. But if you look at the marketization of the actual line, what did we do? What did we see? We stepped back into a time machine. Not a bad thing to do. We stepped back into a time machine, advertised it through things like animation and comic books, just like done in the 80s. Is that how kids find out about toys today? I really wanted and really felt what was missing was the big arcade-style game with Masters of the Universe. And Trent and I've had probably too many conversations, if you ask Trent, about this topic. I've always felt that Masters of the Universe is a property that lends itself to video games so well, but is very rarely tapped into, and when it is tapped into, it's very hit and miss.
Just on that, like, we did a couple episodes ago, I don't remember what episode it was, but we did the 2000X Ninja Turtles line, and there were at least four titles in that arc of the series of video games that were quite prevalent. And whereas, flip it over to Masters, we had one released in Australia here and UK, I think it was, as well. And that was it. And the Americans missed out. And even
and there was a Game Boy Advance game as well.
Yeah. And even to that extent, like, the game's not even that good. Like, it's hard. It's very straightforward. You can only go on one path and things.
We sort of have to talk about vehicles as well, because
that's
this
the
is
big one, isn't it?
It is a big one, because I think you can't. Well, in my mind, I don't know if the demise of the line or why it didn't reach the lofty heights as it did in the 80s is attributable to vehicles. But it's worth pointing out that I think you have to point out to start with on vehicles is the Four Horsemen were responsible for sculpting the figures, Castle Grayskull. Mattel in-house design was responsible for putting out the vehicles. Now, the Horsemen may have been involved in Battle Bones,
for example,
a few bits of pieces.
Battle Cat, Panther, things
those sort of things. But then when you got into things like the core vehicles, they had things like the Bashing Beetle and some sort of
what was that
Battle Ram Chariot.
Rock Wheeler thing called? There's a Rock Wheeler?
I know the one you think. My mind has blanked. It shouldn't have. But
what does
that
look like?
It's a Rock Wheeler. It's a dog.
It's a dog. It comes with a He-Man. Yeah. I know the one you're talking
about. Who doesn't
about.
Want
what?
That in their Masters?
I don't remember that.
Yeah, true story.
A Rock Wheeler?
No,
Rock
Wheeler. I actually have it, but I can't remember the name of it.
So I've got a little matchbox down there. If you have a look at the matchbox, it's all head, tiny little body. That's what the Masters...
I'll get you the name of it.
...vehicle looks like.
But, it's...
The designs were very different. There was so much aesthetic beauty in those original 80s vehicles. Yep. Rotom, Landshark. They had a character, a charisma.
Yeah. Oh, they had the whale. They had the whale
the
as
whale's
well.
Probably about, well...
the War Whale.
Yeah. Battle Ram Chariot, War Whale...
The Rock Wheeler.
Yeah. I can't remember
it
that.
It was released on the Snake Man, Masters of the Universe versus the Snake Man line, and for whatever reason, I can't remember the name of it, but was it the Speeding something? Yeah, anyway, I will get you the name of it, but yeah, it's...
Keep
it was big. It was a big... So basically, that Mattel in-house design... Probably given this brief, here's a toy line, here's the figures, this is what they look like, come up with some vehicles. And they've gone, well, this is what I think would be a cool vehicle without a lot of research into what came before it. You know, instead of Bashosaurus, we got the Bashing Beetle.
And then we got the Dragon Walker that was Dragon Walker in name only.
Yeah. I think that, you know, I didn't personally collect any of the vehicles or didn't go to seek out the vehicles, mainly so because we're probably importing a lot of this stuff.
Yeah.
And I wasn't, for the quality of those vehicles, I certainly wasn't going to import them.
And you got a Raptor instead of the T-Rex, correct?
There was a Raptor. Yeah, there was.
The Spitball. I thought it was Spitball, but I didn't want to confirm it. I knew it was Spit something. Yeah, the Spitball.
How does that work? That's so weird.
I'll show you a picture of it later. But,
so is that something Mattel in-house design cooked up?
Yeah.
Someone either with a Lobo fan.
Or went home, threw the ball with their dog and thought, I'm going to come back to work tomorrow and make this.
It's a mechanical vehicle, but it's no Stridor or Nightstalker, just for those that are wondering. But yeah, I can't believe I forgot the name of it. I remember it when it came out, and I'm one of the few people that actually got all the vehicles and did that partly because I didn't want the line to die. That was my rationale from it. I'll buy all the variants. I'll buy all the vehicles. You know, I may not fall in love with everything, but I want this line to go on and on. But the reality is, I think they weren't sure who they wanted to pitch it to. The figures were very traditional in that they were updates of characters that we grew up with. The vehicles were not. Having said that, there might have been some hope that had the line gone on, we might have got some of those traditional vehicles, because Wind Raider and the Sky Sled made it into both the Mike Young Productions cartoon and the MV Creations comics. So it's not like they weren't in the story, but
it really
just never got that far.
Yeah, what I'm picking up across this whole conversation, and which I probably didn't appreciate at the time, it really feels like it's a tale of two ideas on how
two lines
it was. You had the Four Horsemen going, this is what we want to do and this is the direction we want to take it, and then you had Mattel's idea. And to that point, we've said a couple of times it didn't know what it wanted to be. You know, it seems when you've got two competing ideas that are vastly different to each other, success is going to be hard to come by.
Yeah,
really. And you know, it's not for us to say that, oh, you know, the Four Horsemen are right and Mattel were wrong or the other way around. I just think when you've got two contrasting ideas, you know, it makes things tough.
It's hard, isn't it, mm-hmm. when you're talking about that. And people kept saying online, I'll buy the Wind Raider, I'll buy the Sky Slayer, because I kept seeing them on the cartoon too. So it was almost like, I'm not going to buy this stuff. I've only got so much money. I've only got so much room. I'm going to wait for the good ones.
Yeah.
And they were showing some hope that might come.
Mm. Speaking of the good stuff, there was a lot of good stuff in this line. But we want to go around the room and just talk to maybe a couple of our favourite pieces or figures or characters from this line.
I'll start off because you guys will have way more than me. But look, the one that sort of jumped out to me as, you know, it'd gone from a bit of a whatever figure in the vintage line into something really great was Fisto, or what was he? Battle Fist, yeah. as he was renamed.
Fisto was taken at the time because of
Kit
Fisto.
Kit Fisto in the Star Wars.
Yeah, right. There you go.
So Rattler wasn't available either, so he became the general.
Yeah.
I just think he came off looking as you've got a guy with a big fist, cool, in the vintage line, to just this absolute badass in the new one. And the fist actually, in the figure, had like a spring-loaded sort of function to it. And I was like, that's a great practical, you know, action feature to have. He had a bit more armor on him and stuff. He came with a big sword. And I think that update did wonders for him. Look, there's lots more designs in the Stactions I could speak to, but as far as sticking to the actual toys from those early waves, the Fisto was probably gets my vote.
For me, it all started, we may have ratted on a little bit, but I do love the cartoon. I thought the cartoon was really cool. As for the toy line, I really got into it come the Stactions line. I picked up the first wave when I was country, and then the toy store I was pre-ordered through went out of business, so I failed to get any more after that. But like, hands down, to this day, that's first wave one Snout Spout is still my favorite. Like that, yeah, they captured Snout Spout's attributes and just went, you know, put Turbo. Make him cool. Yeah,
absolutely.
Put Ambrosia in him or whatever they call it. And like, you know, with the hooves and things that he's got for feet, he's got little tusks, not huge prominent things, but he's just, they just point out a little bit. The armor, like he looked armored up to all high heaven. His big ass battle axe looks so freaking cool. Like that not only knocks down a door, it knocks down the whole wall around it. You know, he looks amazing. And then, you know, we've talked about this a million times before, but I was able to pick up almost the whole line of Frank, the Stactions, which is amazing. And I've also got some customs by Real 3D, he goes by. And they are just outstanding. So the customs I've got are a Scareglow and the Horde Trooper, and they are just outstanding. He's also done a Spycore, but I sort of had to pull the pin at the price that they were costing me, so I'm happy with those two. As for the toy line, I've got to call out the General. Like, the General that being the renamed of Ratlaw is just absolutely fantastic, and he was really one of those toys that was just the next size up from the regular Buck. Mm-hmm. So yeah, really, you know, we might rat on the toy line and might rat on some of the things, but there had definitely was some, you know, golden things about it, and the cartoon and the comic book series were fantastic.
Yep,
agreed. I actually really enjoyed the toy line. I know I may not have sounded like that hearing me talking about it today, but I really enjoy what it did well. It did extremely well. As far as favourites go, it's really hard for me with Master of the Universe, because to me there's never any Deadwood. It's just one of those things where every character is a name lister, but it's hard to go past just the moment of seeing them back in retail, actually, for me. So that was a big thing. So I'm just going to say He-Man and Skeletor were standout. Seeing them back in shelves was a big deal in Australia, and you can't really go past seeing Grayskull either. So for me, they were high points.
Cool.
Yeah, I really liked Orko in this interpretation. Yeah, he's cool. I just felt at that time, looking back at the way Orko had been done as a toy, I must admit, I loved the original Orko toy, but at that time, he just felt very basic and very plain. And to see, I guess, what was a fairly comical, whimsical character in Filmation, maybe a character that the toy wasn't interpreted to fit in that well with the line, to see this Orko that had all that detail, you could almost see that fact he had, like, legs in the cloak. You could see a knee sculpted in, but there was nothing sort of coming out the bottom. It was just a really cool interpretation, which I really liked. And he was bigger. He was sort of more value for money in a figure. So I just remember seeing that sculpt, and that really brought me in. I had to get Orko, obviously. Funnily enough, he ended up with two different versions.
Yeah, he did the Trap and Smash variant that came out in the Snake Man wave, which was cool. It was cool to see some of those characters elevated. You know, we talked before with Lee and Hannah about Stratos getting variants in this line, and obviously Man at Arms and Mechanic, and quite a few characters got variants, but quite a lot got repaints too, and some of those repaints were hit and misses, but highlights for me in the repaints were the screen accurate Mike Young Productions repaint that they did for Ramman, and the mini comics
Trapjaw
I thought were real high points, because they were repaints and variants that seemed infinitely sensible, that were paying homage to a past incarnation, or in Ramman's case a current incarnation of said character.
Yeah,
that was terrific.
Yeah, when it comes to repaints, I just love the Too Bad repaint.
Yeah,
because the reverse,
you know. Yeah, I just thought that's such a simple thing to do, and it almost looks like a new figure. Like, same sculpt, just swap the blue and the purple, and you go, wow, this looks awesome. Furthermore, they fleshed out what was, you know, quite a bit of a silly character in the original line, and all of a sudden you just go, this character's interesting. I want to know more.
I still want those two characters, Tubra and Badra, in classics form. Like, I still, to this day, even though I openly admit I cherry pick from Super 7 and things, that is still up there on my wish list for that. A two pack, give it to me at San Diego Comic Con, whatever way it allows that to come out. That'd be awesome.
Very good. Well, that's awesome. That's been great reminiscing about a line that was around when we were all sort of getting back into toy collecting in one shape or another. I know Darren had some lapses in judgment as he exited toy collecting twice in his sort of lifetime. But,
yeah, I did. That whole 6 seconds of horror.
Fell asleep one day.
Let's just say, if you cancel my two favourite toy lines in the same year, Masters of the Universe and Superpowers, as a child, I'm the kind of kid that take his bat and
he'll
ball
take
and go
that.
Home.
You'll take that personally.
Like, fine, I'm not buying it anymore. No. See you later.
We're not playing this game any longer.
It took Tim Burton to win me back 2 years later.
Yeah. Good thing that happened when it did. All right, last segment before we wrap this episode of Toy Power, we're going to try and justify to each other who the best turtle is. Frank, we'll start off with you, seeing you're wearing the Leonardo
beanie. And you know, you should start with me, because Leonardo is the leader, right? Like, let's be honest, he has pulled the butts of the other three turtles out of the fire more times than any other turtle. Look, for me, I love Leonardo because I think even from those early Mirage comics, there's the scene where he basically gets beaten to hell by Shredder and the Foot Clan. And he comes back from that. He's like, all right, now we have to go face down the Shredder again. And that just really resonated with me, that, you know, life can get you down and can be the worst thing in the world, but you know, why do we fall? We get back up, sort of thing. Oh, God, how do I do this? We've just, for those playing at home, we've got no notes of this. This was very much a last-minute edition.
It's an off-the-cuff.
Yeah, I would have loved to have written out a full essay, but anyway.
This is why we sprung it on you now. It's a gotcha moment.
No, so very cool. I like Leonardo in that he's the discipline. It's something I try to do in my own life, not very successfully, but he's a good student as well, which, again, I was not a very good student myself. But everyone, you know, people go, he's boring and stuff. But I find that he's still got that little, he's still a teenager, right? He's still got that sense of humor where he's able to sort of joke around with the guys and the relationship he has with Raph, which really ultimately got fleshed out mostly in the 2003 cartoon and then really well done in the 2007 movie.
Yeah.
That where that was kind of the crux of a lot of the story. I just think that's great. He has this sort of little brother thing going on with Mikey and Donnie. He knows he can count on him and stuff. He's the glue. You know, Donnie's the nerd, Raph's the muscle, and Mikey's the easygoing. Without Leonardo being that center, the other three fall apart, in my opinion.
All right, I'm going to try and justify the best turtle as Donatello. And I know Davey's on me with this one as well. So we're just two peas in a pod, rocking the Donnie, because Donnie is the best.
Also, swords are the best weapon. So
true. Yeah,
did you see that picture he had of Deadpool?
Yes,
and
I did.
Donnie? Yeah, yeah, yep. Yeah. That's probably a more accurate reflection of what Davey thinks of Donnie.
Donnie was my favorite turtle as a kid because he wore the purple bandana, and I had a thing for purple as a 7-year-old or whatever it was. And he had the best reach in the video game.
He did,
so
he did.
That bow staff you might think is pretty crappy, but boy, it can reach. Look, I think there's something very special about someone who's got an affinity with technology, particularly in a sci-fi or action-adventure, because technology is a big part of, I guess, figuring out how to solve problems. And bringing in interesting concepts as well to utilize. So it's been done in different ways through the different incarnations. But I think at heart, like, I'm a massive nerd or massive geek or whatever you want to call it. So there is that connection to someone else who is into that sort of stuff. So, yeah, big fan. Always been a big fan of Donnie.
Good on you.
Cool.
Darren.
So I'm gonna advocate very strongly for Mikey. For me, Mikey's the best for a number of reasons. He's got the biggest heart. He's a far more compassionate character than people give him credit for. But he's also, obviously, the life of the party. But he just has a different outlook on things, and he'll brighten the tone when things look really, really, really gloomy. And when the turtles look like they might be down and out, he'll lift the tone back up. And I think that's really important in that property. I think it works really well. I also think he's probably the most relatable for the audience because he geeks out at things. He's a comic book fan. He loves superheroes. He loves the kinds of things that people that enjoy the Turtles love. So I think he's a very relatable character in that way. I think most of us probably have our moments where we sort of feel a bit Mikey-like, where you're in a situation and you think the tone does need to be lightened because there's so much doom and gloom in the world. And I think he does a good job of doing that. I also think he brings the Turtles together in a different way to Leo, but he brings them together. But sometimes they come together for Mikey because, you know, Mikey's, you know, sometimes he's treated as the joke or the, you know, whatever, and, you know, because he's misunderstood. But there's a love for Mikey that brings them together, a shared love. You know, he's the brother that they can count on in so many different ways, I think. So that would be why I would advocate strongly for Mikey.
You did forget one important thing. Mikey is the current reigning Battle Nexus champion.
That's true.
This is the part where Raphael punches him and goes, "Shut up, Mikey."
Well, I can't. Mine's obviously Raphael being the last one in the room, choice-wise. Mine's Raphael, but I have to admit to the boys, I don't know if I've ever said this before, but my original one was also Donatello.
No!
To the extent that I remember getting the movie-esque vintage Donatello, you know, as a vintage toy. That was my choice. So Donatello was my first. But Raphael's grown on me as I've grown up with the Turtles. And it was my choice, you know, really set in stone when I started getting into the Mirage comics and I started fleshing out the more mature original origins of the Ninja Turtles. And that was, you know, sort of as simple as when I started reading Casey Jones, Raphael one shot, I think it is, and he goes into a bar with Casey Jones, and they're just knocking back beers and having jokes and stuff. And then, you know, there's a Casey Jones Raphael special where it's done in that super hyper heavy metal esque animated, you know, artwork and things, and it's just super violent, super R-rated comic book style. You know, there's no, definitely not for kids and things. And it's just, you know, that's sort of team up storyline, whatever you want to call it, would not happen with any other turtle character. Like, you wouldn't get Donnie and Casey. I think Donnie and Casey paired up, squared off in issue 47 of the Mirage comics or something, just before they hit 50, and they look on the tree branch eyeing off and saying, you know, you've got beef with me, I've got beef with you. So they sort of had that duke out. But instead, you know, the relationship with Casey and Ralph, it's like, let's go and have a beer. Yeah, cool. And you know, looking back at the movie, even though Raphael wasn't the one that actually got bashed up in the comics, it was Frank said, it was Leonardo. You know, you see that dynamic personality with Casey Jones and Raphael getting it, you know, going and having that duke out and things. Repairing the Volkswagen, combi and stuff. And
isn't that Donatello?
Yeah, it is Donnie.
You're thinking like when Casey first meets Raphael, and you know he's got the, you know, two for one sale power.
Yeah,
and cricket. Yeah. Nobody understands cricket.
Yes. I thought it was the other way around. And anyway, I'm getting maybe need time to watch the movie again.
Yeah, it's a good excuse to get out. But the like old VHS.
I relate the Raphael's personality to the same reason why everyone loves Wolverine. You know, he's got that harsh, badass attitude. No, you know, not going to take ifs or buts. Just, you know, get down and dirty and fight, and then we'll work out who's right or wrong later. And, you know, red's always been my favorite color. I painted my toy room red. You know, it's that affection of the everything about the Raphael scheme that I think is awesome. So,
cool.
No one chose Venus de Milo.
No, we
left that one for
no
Davey.
One.
We were meant to have Davey here for special guest, so I'm sure he would have jumped in.
No, I reckon he would have, and I reckon you're probably already on thin ice with Davey, considering you confessed that Donnie.
It's all about opening your heart on the airwaves.
Yeah, that's
so
true.
I don't.
If you can't confess your sins with friends, who can you confess?
No, I haven't told many people that, but that is the honest truth. That Donnie was
wrong with Donnie.
Yeah.
They're all awesome.
They are. Very good. I think we'll...
It's just that Mikey's the best. That's all.
I was going to say, we'll just leave it there, and then he's gone and thrown that in.
Of the Battle Nexus,
Love the hand grenade. Beautiful stuff. Well, on that note, we will wrap this episode of Toy Power and say thank you very much for tuning in. We appreciate you listening to us. And a big shout out to our patrons, John Caulfield, a.k.a. Lux Toy Collector, Jose Gonzalez, Chris Wisdom, Brett G, and John Hayes. It is late here. It's 1:30 a.m. in the morning. Thank you very much, and we will see you around the toy aisles.
Thank you, one and all, and until next time, good journey!
Also, Leo's the best.
You can find the Toy Power team at all the usual online places. Facebook.com/ToyPowerPodcast. At Toy Power Podcast on both Twitter and Instagram. Or have your say and email us, toypowerpodcast@gmail.com. Subscribe to the show on both iTunes and Stitcher, and please leave us a review. Otherwise, we just assume we're awesome.
We are a proud member of the Giant Size Team Up Network. Check out all the awesome shows on this awesome network full of okay people. Want to learn more? Go to GiantSizeTeamUp.com, where you can find us and a whole lot more awesome shows. Well, they're not more awesome than us, but yeah.